This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
This is the last day of the 2017 Bendigo Writers Festival. But before I go any further, I wanted to acknowledge that this city of Greater Bendigo is on both Dja Dja Wurrung and Tungurung country, and their ancestors and descendants have been here as the traditional owners for a very, very, very long time. We acknowledge that this remains their land, and we are very grateful to be on it. I'd like to pay my respects to any Indigenous people that are here today and all elders who are past and present. My name is Emily Sexton. I'm the head of programming for the Wheeler Centre. And it's this afternoon I'm sort of going to pretend at knowing what adulting really looks like, and I'm going to steer this fantastic panel to sort of providing us with all the answers. If you'd like to join me in welcoming Clementine Ford. She's a Melbourne-based writer, speaker and feminist thinker. She's a columnist for Fairfax's Daily Life and a regular contributor to The Age and Sydney Morning Herald. She explores issues of gender inequality in pop culture, and Fight Like a Girl is her first book. Welcome, Clem. Will Costakis is an award-winning author. The Sidekicks is his third novel for young adults, and it was longlisted for the 2017 Gold Inky Award and the Ethel Turner Prize for Young People's Literature. It was also included in the Notables list for the 2017 CBCA Young Adult Book of the Year. Welcome, Will. Kayla Ray Whitaker is an American writer, and her first novel is The Animators. She is a graduate of the University of Kentucky and of the New York University's MFA program. Welcome, Kayla. And over there, hello. Tom Taylor is a number one New York Times best-selling comic book author. He's a screenwriter and a playwright. He's currently the writer for Wolverine for Marvel and Injustice for DC Comics.
Yeah, right.
Tom has written, Batman / Superman, Iron Man, Justice League and Power Rangers, Star Wars and more. He's the co-creator, head writer and executive producer of the animated series The Deep, which you can find on ABC iView and screening on the main channels. And in fact, it's screening in over 100 countries. And he just recently joined the writing team of Clever Man, also on ABC. Welcome, yeah. Tom. So we're talking about the ideas of adulthood, and I think marketers and newspapers love the idea of a sort of generational cliche. They love the idea that youth is the answer to all the consumption and maturity is something to love and to loathe and to fear. But the reality is that for many of us, that getting older is complicated and confusing as much as it is rich and rewarding. And while sociologists would point to completing school, moving home or moving out of home, becoming financially independent, marrying and having kids as sort of the five key adult milestones, I think what we're going to try and explore today is that by focusing on those so pervasively, we're actually concealing some much deeper and more interesting questions about what it means to grow up. So I wanted to start by asking each of you whether you think you're an adult. Tom, do you think you're an adult?
Did you hear that list at the start? Yeah. No, I make cartoons for a living and write superheroes, and I'm sitting here in a Superman t-shirt. Yes, I know intellectually that I'm an adult, emotionally, God, no. The idea of growing up terrifies me. And luckily I have wonderful people around me that let me stay young, okay. Including my own children.
Yeah. Will, are you an adult?
Well, I'm 28 and I achieved one of those milestones this year. I moved out of home.
Well done.
I don't feel any older, but I feel a lot poorer. So thanks to everyone who told me to grow up. Like, really not resentful at all. I don't cry myself to sleep. How about you?
Kayla Ray, are you an adult?
Well, I'm at a funny crossroads where I still have acne, but I am considering Botox. So it's a constant struggle. I put on this blazer this morning, and then, you know, I turned to the people with me and I said, "Do I look like an adult?" So it's a constant struggle, actually, to feel like an adult. I look forward to that.
Okay.
Well, I also have a pimple on my cheek.
I feel like that is, I mean, it's that kind of like age-old tussle of, do you ever really feel like you've grown up? You know, you speak to people who are in their 70s who say, well, I feel like I'm 20 on the inside. And I'm 36, so I'm not quite yet 70, but I still feel like inside I never feel like I get older or wiser. But your body just starts to fall apart. And I've had a baby, so it's falling apart at a much quicker rate now. My baby's just turned one, and I looked at a photo of us the other day, and I was like, right, it's a bit like dog years. He's turned one, and I've aged 10 years. But I wonder as well if there's a sort of... I'd be interested to know the difference in American and Australian sensibilities, because in Australia we're very much down talkers. You know, we're not allowed to boast about our achievements. We're not allowed to talk about... We always have to talk about ourselves as being, like, vaguely a piece of shit, you know? Like, I remember when I first started writing professionally, when I was in America, actually, Americans would say, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a writer, but I'm not a very good one. And I thought, well, in America, where you sort of learn that it's all about talking yourself up, I think, God, they must think I'm a really terrible writer if that's my boasting. Yeah, I don't know. I think that we sort of feel obliged sometimes as well in that self-deprecating way to hype up that we're not really grown up, we're not adults. But how much of that is true, I guess, is what we'll be exploring today.
Kayla, do you want to briefly answer? Do you think there's a cultural difference that you've noticed in the last week in the way people understand?
Quick, be insightful.
Can you sum up Australian history?
Well, you know what, actually, and it's you're not the first Australian who's actually mentioned that to me, and there is, I think, an ideal in America of being a little marketer, and that's definitely something that, you know, we're loud, we stand up for ourselves, you know, and maybe that's a certain ideal, but honestly, I find that there are very real lines separating the genders. Especially in the U.S. and I think the world over, as far as selling yourself is concerned, I think this is a chronic problem for women, feeling infantilized pretty much at every stage of their lives. So, and I am an example of this, because until my book was maybe 3 months away from being published, I was afraid to tell people that I was a writer. And I'd sold a book to Random House. I had an MFA. You know, it's like, I've been doing this for a while. But, you know, I was afraid of calling myself that.
And also I think that we face that really frustrating hypocrisy of being told as women, well, it's your fault that you're not achieving greater heights. It's your fault that you're not making entry into these industries, because you need to talk yourself up more. You need to sell yourself. What I was telling a friend today, that a woman I spoke to recently, who's a 25-year-old law clerk, is working at a law firm in Sydney, and she found out that she's on an hourly rate, and she found out that a man who started after her, who's got less responsibility, who she's actually been told to supervise, is on a higher hourly salary to her. And when she found this out, she went to her boss and the partner, senior partner at the law firm, and she said, you know, I've just found out that I'm being paid less, and I don't think that that's fair. And she would have done it in that very kind of, I'm really, really sorry to bring this up, but I just think that maybe... Anyway, her boss turned around and said to her, well, why didn't you ask for more money at the beginning? You've got to sell yourself more. And so then you're kind of, as a woman as well, in the position of... Them, the overarching kind of power, always being able to turn around and say, well, it's your fault. But if you do talk yourself up, if you do go into that meeting and you say, well, I'm really good at my job and I think I should be paid this, tickets on herself, doesn't she? I heard Kayla talk about herself. Oh, I've got an MFA. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, you become pushy.
Yeah.
I mean, pushy being, I think, the chosen word. You don't want to be a pushy woman, you know? So sell yourself, but not too much.
Sell yourself, but in a way that still makes us feel like we could be in charge.
Exactly. And it's guessing where that line lies. We constantly feel tripped up by it. It's like we can never really get that balance right. We never really know where the line is. It's tough.
This is going to be really fun. mostly because I'm not going to need to do a lot. I wondered for each of you, and we've already started talking about the sort of gender dynamics or maybe the cultural dynamics or the education dynamics, but for each of you, if you had a moment where you knew you were an adult, what was it? And why? What kind of cultural framework would you bring to that moment? Was it about politics? Was it about friendship? Was it about children?
Well, I feel like I've talked most recently, so...
Look, for me, it definitely was children. Our first child was born at home in a swimming pool in my study, which was cool. Megan had Braxton Hicks all the night before, so I hadn't slept for 48 hours. But we had, you know, we had the midwives and we had the whole thing and it was incredible. And we ordered pizza and we watched Batman Begins while the labor was happening. And it was awesome. We warned the neighbors, like, if you hear noises, it's cool. We're living in Heidelberg West, but it's, yeah, right? but it was actually, like, at the end of all of this, the three of us went to sleep together in our own bed and it was waking up the next morning and Megan had gotten up to do something and I woke up and it was just me and him and he was just staring at me and I'm just like, right, like, this is it. This is that moment where I can't go leave. I can't get in my car and drive away and, like, there is something else now that requires me to grow up.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it's irreversible as
Sorry?
Well.
Oh, completely. You can't give that child back. Don't put it back. That's wrong. midwives are very skilled. They're not that quite there yet.
Would you have to play Batman Begins in reverse?
You would have to do Batman Begins in reverse. Yeah.
When did you know that you were an adult?
For me, it wasn't so much that I thought I was an adult, but I sort of understood the adults in my life and that perhaps there's not this one moment when you grow up. So for me, it was... my best friend passed away between years 10 and year 11. And so I took it poorly, obviously. But I was really upset one day and my mum came into my room and she's, you know, strict Greek matriarch. And she's like, William, clean your room. And I'm like, so my default, whenever there was something I didn't want to do, I was like, you don't understand what I'm going through. My best friend just died. And, you know, and she just looks at me and just deadpans and goes, oh, yeah. No, my brother died when I was your age. I have no idea what you're going through. Mm-hmm. And in that instance, where I felt that I had sort of grown up was that I saw her not as the woman who paid the bills or cooked for me or, you know, yelled at me when my room wasn't messy. I saw a whole person who had experienced what I had and who had sort of... it wasn't so much that she was an adult, but that we had this sort of shared experience and that we were sort of just making things up and dealing with things as we were going along. And but I say that as if someone who's super mature, but, you know, if you ever find me online, usually, and people my age as well, because we've sort of grown up, we've gone through our extended adolescence online, and you just see the most popular meme online, something that's shared a lot, is just... someone my age in their mid to late 20s going, oh, I adulted really hard today or I was really bad at being an adult. And we all seem to sort of share that experience of having no idea what we're doing and just sort of celebrating that we're really bad at it. But I don't know how much of that is performance and how much of that is actually, please help us, we have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that we've gone birth and death immediately, that, you know, more than I guess... consumption, as in I bought a house or I bought a car. Yeah. You know, it's these pivotal moments of life. I'm impressed that 16-year-old you saw that much about your mum, because I often feel as a new parent like Clem that I was ultimately a bit of a kid until I became a parent.
But
in
it was
many
this,
ways.
This really strange thing about losing someone, especially in high school, when you're trying to sort of forge your identity, and then you're instantly reminded of your mortality, and straight away I was like, oh wow. Nintendo's fun, but it doesn't actually matter. And I sort of had to grow up quite fast, and everyone I went to school with, we all had to sort of grow up quite fast, and all those sort of petty high school feuds almost evaporated overnight, and we sort of just had to grow up, really.
And this is obviously the premise for Sidekicks.
Yeah, so that inspired me to write The Sidekicks, and I wrote part of it when I was in year 12 and still sort of working through that grief.
Wow. But it took you, I guess... quick maths, 10 years to be able to
I always
write that
told myself I wasn't good enough to write it. And I was like, no. And so I was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Award. I'm like, no, still not good enough to write it. It's going to be like my book. And then I visited his mum and I went to his house and I saw a photo of him on the fridge. And I looked at him and I'm like, I've forgotten what you look like. And I realised if I was going to write anything that was, it's not autobiographical, but it's obviously inspired by my feelings at the time, I'm like, I need to record this down before I forget. Because I can't be an adult writing about that experience. I have to remember what it was like to be a 16-year-old who had no idea what he was doing, dealing with this experience.
Which is actually a very adult way of understanding it as well. Ironically.
Yeah.
Kayla, we'll talk about your adult reckoning, but The Animators is very much about, you know, takes death and friendship as a very two incredibly important themes as well. Were you in this, what was your relationship, or what is your relationship to death as a sort of way that we advance our understanding of life, and how did you use that in the writing of your first novel?
Well, you know, I think that when death happens, and when you're very young when it happens, you know, when you're maybe under the age of 20 or 25, there's a tendency to look at your life as split into two pieces, before the death and after death, you know, and there's you, but there's also the world. It's just everything looks different. There's something about that understanding of loss and the little pieces of loss, like forgetting what someone's face looks like, forgetting what their voice sounds like, you know, or cleaning out their clothes and catching their scent after a couple of years and realizing that your sensory memories of this person are so fragile, and this is one of the things that you will lose that you never expected that you would lose. So when I was growing up, I had one parent who was chronically ill and who passed away when I was 19. And so there was a certain amount of, it was almost as if with every hospital visit and every emergency room visit, I kind of got this little glimpse of adulthood. And then at 19, when it happened, there was sort of something ripped open and I came into some sort of adult understanding, I think, internally. Externally, I think I became an adult. The first experience that came to my mind was the first time I paid taxes. And like every American, I'm terrified of the IRS. Nobody wants to see that little angry eagle on the outside of their envelope, you know, in their mailbox. So nobody wants to be audited. Terrible. So there's sort of internal and external ways of becoming an adult, I think. And it happens in fits and starts. So I think to say that millennials are in sort of a case of arrested development, I think, is to sell us short. Like baby boomers, like, you know, like a lot of generations before us, but especially like our parents, I would say, you know, we're sort of a patchwork of adult and youth. And I think for better or for worse, we will remain that way, I think for as long as we live, we remain that way.
I'm actually, just a second, Clem, because I'm going to come back to you, Tom, because superheroes and writing superheroes is a kind of ultimate denial of death. Almost none of the DC or Marvel worlds would, it's very, very rare for a superhero to actually die. Nearly all, right?
Yes, no. Well, the problem with superheroes is they tend to die 1 week and then come back a few months later. And everyone goes, oh my God, Wolverine's dead. Currently Wolverine is dead, and I'm writing a new Wolverine who's a woman.
Yes.
And she's been Wolverine for 2.5 years. So
feminization.
I know. Disgusting. You've seen
the internet. Is there nothing the feminists won't run?
I know. It's appalling.
But everyone likes the Lady Wolverine.
Oh, God, yeah. She's amazing. Yeah, she kicks ass. My point being... But I think what superheroes gives you, and, you know, I touch on this a bit, but the reason superheroes are so big at the moment, every time comics do well, it's in times of like hard times, basically, times of depression, times of war, that's when comics flourish. And at the moment we have pop culture dominating everything. I mean, we have Captain America and the Avengers and Wonder Woman, and like these are the things that are selling, and people are flocking to it in droves. And we're going to it because people are kind of disenfranchised and they see the leadership we have and just go, we want something nicer. Mm-hmm. We want a better ideal. I mean, you're actually talking to the wrong person when you're talking about death, because my most successful book, which is Injustice, which is the, sold a couple of million copies and it's insane, that starts with Superman being tricked into killing Lois Lane and their unborn child.
Wow.
And that wasn't mine. Somebody's made me do that. Someone made me fridge Lois, and I called my mum and told her that they wanted me to do this, and it was very sad. Thank you for being here for me while I said that. Anyway, so there are deaths, and deaths are always a big part of superhero comics, but usually they're a reason for the hero to step up. It's the reason for Laura Kinney as Wolverine to step up, because her father's died and, you know, she has a legacy to inherit. So it's always a big one, but certainly that ideal that there is something less cynical, something that we can aspire to, something that actually brings hope, is a great reason to write superheroes.
Yeah. Mm. Clem, what was your moment of adult reckoning where you knew that you were an adult?
Well, I don't think that there was a specific moment, but listening to all three of my co-panelists here has sparked different memories. You know, I've had a child, so I've experienced birth, but I've also lost a parent. I've lost a parent and I've lost a, you know, very close friend. And I feel like I never felt as childlike as in the moment of death, because I was confronted with... my mum died when I was 25 and my friend died when I was 34, so I was an adult. But I was confronted with not just mortality, but this sort of very childlike... lack of understanding about what had happened. And I remember feeling very strongly with both circumstances this sort of panic that I didn't know what would I didn't know what had happened to their bodies. I mean, I knew that they had both been cremated, but I didn't know what had happened to their bodies. And when I thought about not being able to hold them and touch them and smell them again, I felt so adrift and alone. And it didn't make me feel like, well, this is the moment that I've grown up. It made me feel like it was the moment that I was right back to being a sort of vessel of innocence and in need of protection from the cruel, harsh reality of the world. Then when I gave birth to my baby, and, you know, a lot of people think, well, this is the moment where you grow up. I don't feel like for me it was the moment that I said, well, now I'm an adult because I have this child to look after. In fact, when we brought our baby home from the hospital, I remember looking at him. He was like 24 hours old. And I remember lying on the bed and looking at him and just thinking, I've made a terrible mistake. And I didn't feel it in a humorous way at the time, but I tell it humorously now. But it only lasted for a flash because this maybe is where the adult part of my brain kicked in. And it was the adult part that you have to have if you do suddenly become responsible for a completely helpless, innocent, tiny human being. Was that previously, when I only had myself and my own neuroses to kind of engage with and indulge, I would have felt that feeling and I would have gripped onto it and I would have held onto it and I would have become obsessed with it, and it would have become this cycle of panic that, you know, I would have descended into. I had a terrible pregnancy because of these issues, you know, right? Terrible mental illness. But I felt it, and then there was something else that kicked in that said, no, you can't let your brain go there. You can't. You have to be here to take care of this baby. I mean, it felt like something bigger than me that was directing that feeling. And so maybe it's not that was what made me an adult, because I feel like the other thing that parenthood has done to me is, and it's similar to what Will was saying, is that it's made me realize how my parents had no blueprint. They had no idea what they were doing. They were just doing it as we all do, which is our best. Mm. So it kind of gave me permission to go easy on myself about the fact that I didn't know anything, but also that to recognise that I would at least try to be the person that my baby needed. So that was kind of an adult moment. But I mean, I think that some of this is philosophical and some of it's practical. It's easier in some ways for us to be adults now or it's easier for us to be irresponsible because, you know, life is easier. We have more things to help us get through the day. But at the same time, that's used as a criticism against young people. You don't take any responsibility. You know, when I was your age, I was buying a house, et cetera, et cetera. So this whole sort of consumer kind of consumption as a marker of adulthood. But we're dealing with completely different you know, capitalist frameworks now. I was looking, reading an article on Domain before this panel today, and it was about a two-bedroom house with no living room in Pran that is sold at a steal for $750,000. And it was described as being an excellent way for new people to get into the market. And so you read that as a young person. I mean, I'm 36, so how young is that really? You read that and you're like, well, how can you possibly kind of gather and establish all of these markers, these traditional markers of adulthood, when you're playing a completely different game? There's no way that I'll be able to get into the housing market. And even if I could, it's ludicrous to expect that $750,000 for a two-bedroom house with no living room would possibly be a good entry point into the market. So when I've got friends who are living lives completely unlike anything I'll ever live, buying their first house with their family with three bedrooms, and it's a $1.5 million, you think, well, how can I ever be an adult in that kind of game? It's impossible.
Mm. I'm interested in a couple of things that you guys have mentioned about your own mental health and the ways in which you've moved through that as a sort of alternative indicator an alternative indicator of sort of growth and maturity. What's been your experience with that, Clem?
Well, it's not. I don't know if I've ever connected it with concepts of adulthood, because it's something that I've experienced my whole life. Mm. And I've had at different points in my life, starting from my first memory of a really bad mental health crash was when I was 12. Right. And it's sort of like peaked at different points of my life. And the only thing that I can ever establish as a link between all of them in terms of how it makes me feel is just incredibly, terrifyingly alone. And that didn't make me feel any older. It just made me feel alone and scared, which it was, you know, the only thing that made me feel better actually was reaching out to people and connecting and recognizing how similar everyone's experiences are. But the sense of being disconnected from everyone when you are in that kind of mental health, the way that I experience it, as if you're in a room but you're in a glass jar and you can't quite reach out and touch anyone, or sometimes it feels like you're watching a movie but you're on the inside of the TV screen and everything's happening outside of you and you can't connect to anything. It's funny because it's one of those things I'm not going through a mental health episode at the moment, so it's hard to imagine what it feels like when you are in it. But the moment that it starts again, you're like, oh, hello, old friend. Fuck off.
Would do any of you relate to that? Is there ways that as you've grown up, you've approached your own health, in whether it's physical or mental, in different ways? Do you notice that about yourself?
Well, I think there's a tendency to be more proactive about your mental health simply because you don't want to make yourself miserable. Or, well, I mean, you're not making yourself miserable. That's poor phrasing. But you know that seeking out help and reaching out to professionals and to loved ones is the fastest sort of tunnel out of yourself. Mm. And I think that's something millennials are actually, we're more comfortable with this, I think, as a generation than any generations that have really come before. I think there's less of a stigma on mental illness, and there's certainly, well, the shame is still present. It's still ever present, but I think we're more willing to try to talk our way out of our own shame. And that's certainly been my experience, and while, you know, being open about things like my alcoholism, you know, I published something about that, and it was terrifying, but, you know, getting to make those connections with other people who had experienced the same thing was a godsend. It was a salvation. Mm. So, you know, we're peeling back at least some sort of stigma, which I think is very encouraging.
I mean, Will and Tom, you are in probably the most at-risk group in Australia in terms of, you know, young men and suicide, I imagine. I don't know your exact ages, but probably. You know, what are the ways in which you see yourself and perhaps your friends, your male friends, shifting the way that you look after yourselves alongside getting older?
It's really interesting because in terms of mental health and in terms of communicating emotions and things like that, something that I learned very early on, where I was the one who would always talk about my feelings, especially when my friend died, but none of my other mates did, whether it was me just being camp and loud and or whether it was simply because I was just more used to it because I wrote a lot and I was used to communicating my feelings more. But I learnt that, you know, if I wanted one of my friends to talk to me, I knew they'd have to have three or four beers first. And so that's something where I had the first real honest conversations with the friends that I'd known since year seven when we turned 18 and sat in a bar and they could have three or four drinks. And but the really funny thing is that I've started to notice now is moving into sort of my mid-20s and our sort of, you've probably noticed this, but and someone put this thing up on Twitter, which was the most amazing thing ever, where they put up a photo of the gladiators from the TV show 20 years ago. And the guy who posted this is about my age. He's like, oh, you know, back when I was a kid, these were these superhuman people, right? But now it's just the local barista. And where everyone has these superhuman bodies. And so in terms of male mental health, I think it is tied into, I don't want to say vanity, but it is the amount of people my age who I know who take not only supplements, but prohibited hormones and things like that to attain sort of a perfect body and things like that, where I don't think we're really talking about, as in amongst friends, our mental health, but it's our physical health. And it's usually things like obsessive things like I'm going to eat, I'm going to count every single calorie, I'm going to do all these things. And I'm noticing it now and I see it with myself. And so whenever I catch that voice in my head, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to eat a really big cake. And just to be spiteful. But then there's another voice in my head that's like, no, it's fine. If you binge on something sugary, then your body metabolizes it faster than if you broke it up and had little by little every single day. Which is frightening because I'm still eating a whole Sara Lee cake. But yeah, it's this really weird, and the horrible thing about it is you can talk about mental health and people understand, they're like, yes, you're going through anxiety, that's a bad thing. But we haven't found the right way to talk about, oh, I look after my body, I'm being healthy, which sounds like a good thing. I'm looking after my wellness and my fitness. And yet the thing is, we found a very unhealthy way to sort of deal with that. And now, you know, if I don't go to the gym 3 days in a row, I feel bad. And that's really weird. And couple that with, in terms of getting older, everyone was always like, oh, you know, yeah, your metabolism stops when you're 26. I'm like, no, I'm Greek, it goes forever. And then I turned 26 and I'm like, oh, I can't eat McDonald's anymore. Oh, that was sad. And so I have started to notice, and, you know, having to sort of pay attention to having to diet to maintain a particular body weight and things like that, which is, you know, horrible and frightening. And sort of finding a way to balance that part of getting older with not wanting to veer into sort of obsessive territory.
Right. Yeah. Tom, where do you sit in relation to, you know, what yourself or what your male friends talk about in terms of looking after yourself?
I will say what I've found is that particularly for us, our partners have been really good at, like, nudging us, like, talking to our friends behind our back to say, hey, go out and get him drunk, please, this weekend. As you say, it's after three drinks that they will actually talk. And I was thinking when you were talking earlier about death and other people were like, I can't think of any of my friends who've died from natural causes. Like, I think every friend I've lost has been suicide, which is kind of terrifying. But we are getting better at isolating that we do. We've actually worked out, particularly as guys, we've gone, we need times as guys to just get together and hang out, which is a very strange thing. And this being televised, hopefully they won't hear. We organised this week, so my wife and her friends have a book club, and we've organised not book club, as a counterpoint to that, where you don't have to do any homework, and it's lawn bowls and beer. And that's starting next month. We're really looking forward to it. But there's like 15 guys who are going to maybe show up if we want, and if we don't want to, we don't have to either. Mm-hmm. But I think that kind of just touchstoning every now and then. There was a report in the UK that said that basically guys who spend time with other guys twice a week have a much higher mental health and a much lower suicide rate. And that's insane. I mean, for me, it's there's an extra difficulty because I was raised by a single mum, and she worked in a women's refuge, and I was surrounded by women, and we lived with women, and I've always gotten along better with women. My best friend's a woman, you know, I've been with my wife for 20 years. So for me, there's an extra little layer of difficulty there, but just realizing that it is important, and even if it takes three drinks to actually open up and say, yes, I've had a crappy week, and this is why work sucked today, as opposed to, look at me, I've been at the gym, none of my friends go to the gym. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, can't relate at all. But yeah, no, it's incredibly important, and it's kind of shunned as well.
Can I just add to that firstly, the kind of, particularly in a country like Australia where there's a very solid, regressive and reductive, I think, vision of what masculinity is allowed to be, I think contributes to this. As an outside observer, I would say that contributes to the, you know, the reasons why men might need to have a few beers in order to talk to each other, or like cry over a football game or whatever it might be. But, and I'm saying this not as a criticism of either of you, but just a general observation that one of the things that differentiates between men and women in that scenario, particularly women who are in heterosexual relationships, is that they have to be the adults in the relationship and take on the labour of making sure that their partner is okay. And it's in addition to all of the other mental load that we perform, the emotional labour that we perform, the invisible kind of things that happen to make sure that the household functions in a smooth fashion. And I mean, I was again saying to Susan Carland today after our session that, correct me if I'm wrong, but do they have in men's toilets, public service announcements encouraging you to make your wife go to the doctor to get a pap smear?
Yeah, heaps. No.
They don't. But in women's toilets in this country, there are PSA poster. There's a poster campaign talking about how prostate cancer affects so many more men than breast cancer. So make sure that the men in your life go to the doctor. Well, okay, it's great that men should go to the doctor, but why is that women's responsibility to do that? Why do we have to be framed as the adults for men who are allowed to kind of get away with not stepping up to the plate for their own lives? Mm. And I say that because I think that it's much easier, you know, we're all sort of sitting here and we started off with some self-deprecating jokes about how we don't really feel like adults, etc. But the reality is that it's much easier for you and Will to be self-deprecating about your adulthood than it is for Kayla and Emily and I. We can be self-deprecating to a point, but we can't exhibit actual failures of adulthood. You know, there's no sort of sense of the rafish young girlish girl that just gets away with being a little bit of a scamp, you know. We don't have that same liberating freedom. And I think that that's important to mention here and important to talk about, particularly in the context of what you both have said, that if we do live in a country where men are simultaneously not being expected to be adults in terms of taking on the kind of like general labour of a family or labour of the household, but at the same time also told, well, you've got to man up, you've got to be a man, you can't express your feelings, then it creates this really bad situation for everybody.
Do you guys want to respond to that? What do you think?
I'd say it creates a bad situation for everybody.
Yeah.
I think it is. I mean, we are. I think I was reading something the other day that basically said that we are currently, you know, being raised to be children in a way. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I know my wife takes on way more than I do. And there are times when absolutely, like the moment I was talking about before, with my child waking up and me waking up and seeing him face to face, I think she'd probably been the adult up till that point in our lives. Mm. And I don't think I'd even considered, oh my God, I have responsibilities up until that. But in particular, and after that, it was mainly still financial, you know, and it's because we made that decision together. Mm. But she is certainly more of an adult than I am. Mm. She's a doctor now. That's cool. just wanted to point that out. So that's totally adult, though. But no, it is. It's completely fair to say. But we do have this thing that we're told that to man up, to never talk about your feelings, to cry is a weakness, to, you know, to actually call your mate and say, hey, you want to get a beer because I've had a shit day, or I've, you know, something's happened, or you know, even a family member has died. Like, there isn't that we're not allowed to reach out in that way.
But what I sort of want to test is, like, I have a pretty great bullshit detector when it comes to the male stoicism. Like, is it definitely obvious to everyone else as well, like, that it's all an act? Does anyone... Do you feel that way when you talk to your mates? Like,
I think it's an act with a lot of my mates, and then there are some you're like, oh, man, you really are like that. Yeah, you are that close. Like, but that's because they're completely shut down as a child and not allowed... Yeah, maybe it was beaten out of them. I don't know.
It's just that what I find really fascinating is when you go to hang out with them, you get the... And I'd love to compare what it's like. Say you're catching up with someone who you haven't seen for about, say, 2 months, a high school friend. If I'm catching up with them, it'll be the small chit-chat, and then we'll talk basically about nothing or about movies and things like that. And in the last 5 minutes, they'll find something that's like this really heavy, heavy thing, and then say it as they're rushing out of the door. Mm. Is that, I imagine, I don't want to make any generalizations on gender here, but if two women are catching up, I'm pretty sure that's what you lead with. Like, that's what I lead with. And
well, I mean, it depends on how close you are, I guess. Yeah. You know, no one wants to open a conversation with someone they're not... If you haven't seen them for 2 months, then you probably wouldn't open with something really heavy. But, I don't obviously have any male friends because I hate men.
Don't worry, I'm getting the vibe. It's all good. That's why I put Kayla between us. It's fine.
I don't have that experience with my male friends, and I didn't have that experience really growing up with my dad and my brother. I mean, my dad is in many ways sort of a quintessential kind of Australian man. You know, he was born in the country. He grew up in the country. He's a conservative voter because he was farming background. We fight about it a lot. You know, he sort of was raised to be stoic, and he told us that it wasn't until my mum met him that he had hugged his dad as an adult, because she saw him with his father, and they were, you know, he's got three brothers and one sister, and the brothers were all shaking the father's hand and shaking each other's hands. And my mum said, what are you doing? That's really weird. And he said, well, he told her that, you know, when he was 13 and he went to boarding school for the first time, he went to hug his dad goodbye, and his dad said, put his hand out and said, no, you're a man now and men shake hands. And so he just always did. And my dad is actually a very emotional person. His favourite movie is Miss Potter. he's 6'4", he writes bush poetry, you know, but he's got a big booming voice. So he gets away, he passes as an Australian man, but he's sort of learned over the years, I guess, to... When my mum said to him, that's a really strange thing to do, why didn't you just hug your father? He did it, and apparently it was very awkward at the time, but thankfully my grandfather didn't pull back and make him feel ashamed of it. And then it became this thing that all of the men in the family now just hug. And so my brother was raised as a very physically affectionate, intimate family. My brother and my dad hug and say, I love you, and they kiss each other. So it was just never kind of anything that I grew up with. It's always been strange to me to observe it as being absolutely a very real thing, because I didn't have that influence from men. Which is maybe why when I talk about it in such a critical way, the men especially who do have that strong sense of what a man is supposed to be and maybe are afraid of engaging with that, react so in such a hostile way when I talk about it. Because it's confronting for them to think about a world not only where they may have that kind of connection with other men, but what it means if they understand that they can have that connection and they've missed out on all these years of having it. So it becomes, I think, it's understandable, although unfortunate, that a lot of them are very resistant to engaging with it. And also homophobia is rife in this country.
Is it? I would not know.
You would not know.
But, you know, it's a, like, very thin line between homophobia and misogyny. And you know, until we break those barriers down, I don't see how, as, you know, you can have as many men's sheds as you want, but until you break down the actual barriers around what it means for men to be intimate with each other in a platonic and sometimes physical way, then you'll still always be battling that.
I want to touch on something that you all mentioned, which is the relationship of alcohol to all of this, for men and for women, or other kinds of drugs or substances. It's interesting because, you know, when you think about, my partner teases me because he says that I never rebelled against my parents and that I'm a freak as a result, because that's what kind of charges you into adult, is that moment of rebellion. But and drugs and different kinds of illicit substances are often the kind of moments that you're projecting forward as a teenager. But it carries something else, other kind of cultural and social weight for a range of purposes as we grow up. For each of you, you know, what do you think that, like, I feel like that it kind of straddles sort of kid-like behaviour with no responsibility and I'm an adult so I can do what I like kind of excuses as well. Mm. What do you think that is the role? I mean, Kayla, I'd be interested for your mm-hmm. perspective on that in particular, I guess.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I had my first drink when I was 16 and I started drinking in earnest when I was about 17. And I think what was maybe distinctive about my drinking and probably what marked me as an alcoholic right away was the fact that I did most of my drinking by myself. You know, I wasn't terribly interested in going out and partying or sharing this practice with anybody else. It was a refuge from the parts of my life and the parts of myself that burdened me. And, you know, I think a big part of that, you know, what we were just talking about, you know, is women kind of serving as the interpreter of, you know, the emotional lives of the men around them and being taught to be ultra sensitive to the feelings of others and very receptive to the feelings of others. And in a way, and that's really bad for men because men are kind of separated from their own emotional lives and their own emotional health in that way. I think I was conditioned as a female very early and exactly in that way. And I felt it as a very real weight. And that was one of the reasons why I think I started drinking. Drinking was a safe space for me. And it was, I think, unfortunately, you know. Also, when I was 5, I used to like to find Diamond Tap and take hits off of it because it made me feel good. Nobody told me what an alcoholic was when I was 5. I had no idea. I just knew my body chemistry and what felt good. So in a way, it was a part of myself that kind of transcended youth and adulthood. And it had a lot to do with I think gender conditioning and a lot to do with how I was very slowly being taught to, this is how a woman operates in the world. And I couldn't help but see that process of becoming a woman as very much slowly but surely disappearing. And that was a realization that I desperately wanted to hide from. I wanted to remove myself from it. And the only way I knew how to do that was by drinking. And so by 21, I was, you know, putting shots in my coffee when I woke mm-hmm. up in the morning. I fell into it very, very quickly. And, you know, it's our defense mechanisms kill us, I think, in many ways. They'll attempt to kill us if you don't find some sort of intervention. So it was, yeah. And it's hard for me to call that youth or adulthood. I'm still not quite sure. So I think it's just...
I mean, coming out of it surely is a marker of adulthood in some way.
Maybe. At the same time, I was the youngest person I knew who was sober, and it was really right. terrible to go to college parties when I was, you know, 21, and it's like yeah, sure. people are, you know, taking shots around me, and it's just like, oh, God, I have to get out of here. I would just chain smoke through those parties. So in a lot of ways,
I almost felt too young for it, and I think American drinking culture, particularly on college campuses, it's almost kind of like a, you know, it's given as this decent excuse for binge drinking. It's almost, it's like, well, they're, you know, they're college kids, they're partying, and your chemistry is your chemistry, you know, and substance abuse is substance abuse. So that was, yeah, it was complicated.
We're going to come to your questions in just a minute or two, so get them ready. But I did want to hear your perspectives on that as well.
On alcohol as a social lubricant? Or
On a strange kind of bridge between casting forward and casting back between adulthood and youth.
I think there's... Look, I remember, like, I think the first time I got drunk, I was about 12, and I wagged school with a bunch of friends, and we drank an entire goon, and I accidentally walked in front of a train. And I remember thinking, that was awesome. It was such a great day. And the train stopped, and he waved, and he told me, he yelled at me, and I left. And I remember, but I think what it does, and this is coming back to an earlier point we're making, alcohol for guys means, well, we're not technically in control, so we're allowed to talk to you about going and maybe getting that spot checked by a doctor. Whereas any other time, if something goes wrong with you, if you're bleeding, like every Australian male will say, oh, you're not going to go to a doctor for that, are you? Because there's a stigma on admitting that you're injured, apparently. Mm-hmm. Whereas alcohol, I know, like I don't drink heavily. Like that's, I just happened to do that when I was 12. But it is something that we know. If we're catching up and we have a few beers, that's when my mate is going to say something. That's when, and if there that isn't there, probably not.
It's
we'll just play some video games and we won't say anything. We won't say anything about anything. We'll say, how's work? Oh, it's all right. You? Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Because that's adulting. Yeah.
Mm. Will?
Well, I'm someone who doesn't drink, mostly sort of by choice. I don't really enjoy it very much. I'm a very loud person as it is. Give me two drinks, I'm just louder and sleepier. So not really pleasant company. So it's that really... You do feel sort of like an outsider where I'm ready to tell everyone how I feel, but I have to wait for everyone else around me to catch up. And so, you know, I sit there with my sparkling waters and I wait and I wait. And then it happens and it's great. But it's really strange, you know, building those connections. These are the people I've known for my entire life. And yet the only time we'll be honest with each other is when we can, what you said, it's like, oh, I wasn't in control. And but for me, that's, you know, hello, you know, a closeted 20-something-year-old, you know, a few drinks, and then, oh, something happened, oh. So that, you know, and it was that sort of, it was an excuse, either to tell ourselves or to tell others. So, and I think that's the thing, we're not only just putting up a mask for the world, but we're putting up a mask to ourselves, because everything that we project out into the world and all the things that we think people are judging us for, we're also judging ourselves for. And that goes for toxic masculinity, but I'm sure that goes for a whole host of other things as well. And, you know, what it means to be an adult, like I grew up without a male role model because, you know, dad, you know, didn't pay child support and just ran off and decided he was such a great father, he'd try it all again. but and so I was raised by two strong women, my mother and my grandmother. And so for me, you know, I'm kind of rambling, so I'll tie it up. But I sort of noticed that I didn't have the ability to talk to people. And so I just vowed to myself growing up, okay, I'm going to just say everything and not hold anything back, whether that comes from losing someone with things left unsaid, or whether it was just a symptom of growing up and being campus or hell. But it's really fascinating to see how much restriction we put on ourselves, whether we don't want to be judged for our sexualities, for our behaviours, for our thoughts, for our showing our weaknesses. And how much of our lives do we waste being absolutely scared? And I think the marker of adulthood, hopefully, is like you meet my grandmother and she doesn't give an F about anything. And I think that's probably adulthood nirvana.
Oh,
All right, we don't have long, so let's get straight into some excellent questions. If we want, there'll be a microphone right here. Who would like to ask? Well, there's someone up the back.
It's interesting how alcohol can be used either to conceal or to, well, to conceal, but in different ways. Mm. A friend of mine, when I was in high school, he came out when he was 20, same as you, and he never drank at high school parties. He always said, oh, I'm just not interested in drinking. And later on, he said it was because he was so terrified that he would get drunk and say something slip up. So to live with that pressure all the time of that you might reveal your real self to someone. And whereas I'm similar but the opposite in that I always feel compelled to drink because I have to conceal my awkwardness and conceal my, you know, the sort of insecurity and sense that you're always, the social anxiety of feeling like you're always disappointing people, so you just drink just to kind of like dull it a little bit.
The funny thing is, for me to come out to my closest male mate, I had to wait sober for him to get drunk so that I could talk to him about it. But I also knew that if he didn't take it well, I could get him a little more drunk than he'd forget.
Well, it's a question up the back.
Will, you spoke about male vanity and that idea of going to the gym and wellness, in quotation marks. In our this millennial generation, do you, and I'm interested in what you think of this as well, Clem, do you think that this is the first time that men have felt such pressures to be physically attractive? And is it maybe such a negative thing from the feminist movement that instead of making women more free to have less constraints on our physical appearance, we've just put constraints on men?
Well, I'd just like to say that I don't think that that's the fault of the feminist movement.
No, not as a fault. I mean, as a sad thing.
I think it's more they were like, oh, we've made so much money making women feel like shit. And we've missed, you know, 49% of the population. Let's give them a turn.
Yeah.
And there was never a point in my life growing up where I didn't feel absolutely inadequate in the way that I looked. Whether it was, you know, the small things like talking to a friend going, oh, hey, you know when you go to sleep and you want to sleep on your ear and you fold your ear over? Because I used to have protruding ears. And my friends would look at me like, no. And so before I turned 23, I had a nose job and my ears pinned back. And I also had, you know, you think of the all the things that you spend on your body. I had my chest completely lasered. I paid to go to the gym. I went to the gym, you know, 5 or 6 times a week. Slipped 2 discs in my lower back when I was 18 from just working too hard. And, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then the funny thing was, what I noticed, and I think it was a sign of growing up, was that I was then like, oh, and then the fashion changed. Suddenly models had protruding ears and Roman noses and chest hair was back. I'm like, no, you told me it was gone forever. And so it was really, and so for me, I don't know if this answers your question, but it was just to tie it back to the adulthood thing, it was that realizing that you have to be at peace with yourself and you can't listen to the outward influences. Because me, I still look at myself in the mirror and I can point out things I don't like. And the funny thing was, I had a nose job thinking, oh, that'd fix everything. Like, it, you know, all celebrities have nose jobs and they're fine. And so I looked at myself in the mirror, I'm like, oh, well, I don't really like it. Oh, okay. And I realized that voice in my head was never going to go away. So I had to just learn to just accept myself for who I was. And but I don't think it's feminism's fault I feel that way.
I think that a large part of it has to do with, as you said, selling things to people, but also the fact that we can live in a way now that is very much performed and posed for other people.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not coming down 100% on selfies and railing like, selfies are terrible. I understand why people take them, but I think that the act of presenting your best self to people has, you know, very negative consequences. I also think it's interesting, I'm not presenting this as a solid thesis, but the fact that you're a gay man and you experience the same, gay men experience the same sense of being underneath a male gaze and underneath the pressures of what that entails and you know, having to aspire to the body beautiful that straight men seem to experience less of. So there's this sort of like dual idea between heterosexual women, well, not even heterosexual women, because all women are subjected to the male gaze. Gay men and women, that they have to appeal to a man's eyes or to the male eyes. But that you know, certainly the female gaze doesn't prompt anywhere near the same response.
The really funny thing was I took my friend to a gay bar in San Francisco and a guy kept hitting on him relentlessly and sort of trying to grab him, and he walked in and goes, oh my God, is that what it's like to be a woman? I'm like, yes. but no, what you're right. No, it's that sort of, I have the male gaze.
It's a compliment. Yeah, you should have just taken it as a compliment. Probably didn't even happen that way.
It was the way that he was dressed.
That guy was probably just wanted, he probably just wanted to take him out on a romantic date.
And it was, I have that male gaze, but not only do I project that on my partner, but I project it on myself as well.
So. Well, I'm just going to do one more question, even though the countdown clock is very angry at me. Just
hi, I was just something maybe you haven't touched on yet, is maybe the idea of sexuality and how that kind of plays a role in adulthood, I guess, and kind of bridging the gap between youth and adulthood, and I think particularly for young women.
Mm. Kayla? In 25 words or less.
Yes. It's not a cheerful sentiment, but honestly, it comes back to that issue of valuation. The older I get as a woman, the more aware that I am sort of a piece in a market, and I'm terrified of, I think all women are kind of aware of, oh God, I am sinking into invisibility. Like it's happening bit by bit, you know. So I don't think we've come very far, quite honestly. There's something about third wave feminism. I don't think the promises of second wave feminism, I think when we were very young girls, you know, that all of this will be ameliorated when you are an adult. I think that was very much a fantasy.
It was optimistic.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I agree with that, but I also think that, in a positive note, the link between sexuality and adulthood and women, hopefully for a lot of women they experience this, not all do, which is sad, but as you become physically more sexually responsive and more in charge of your sexuality, you also become, I found that I've become a lot more liberated, both, I guess, like in terms of action and also in terms of how I feel about myself and my connection to my sexuality, which at 12 was, you know, one of terror and fear and fear of my sexual feelings as well. Mm-hmm. And the sense that I had to apologize for being a sexual creature, that this wasn't what girls were supposed to do or supposed to be. And now that kind of sense of liberation, I guess, is a positive result of progress.
Sure.
The way that, particularly in the West, the way that elder women are made invisible is, it does sort of end up feeling a little bit desperate. And not even, I don't feel that in terms of, like, I'm worried that men will stop sexually desiring me, because I'm not sure all that many of them sexually desire me now anyway. And I don't care, by the way. Because that's not the most important thing, but it's the sense that suddenly, like, you cease to become a person. Like, if you don't exist even, if we can't even sexually desire you while you're talking, then why should we listen to you at all?
Yeah, it's that issue of social visibility, and it's, you know, it's linked sort of by tendrils to actual sexuality. It becomes something that's completely separate from you, and that's terrifying. You know, that something that is so intimately linked to the way in which you are seen and heard has very little to do with who you actually are.
Mm. And on that incredibly optimistic note,
sorry.
I think the last hour probably demonstrated that these guys know a lot about being adults and being sophisticated in how they understand the world. So if you'd like to join me in thanking these great minds, that would be great.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.